Reset the podcast is brought to you in association with Liars, the non-alcoholic spirits brand. Whether it's low alcohol or no alcohol, Liars helps you enjoy your classic favourite cocktails.
Hello everyone, my name is Suki Thompson. Welcome to Reset the podcast. A place for you to get some inspiration and advice to help you live a more fulfilling work life. I do hope that your journey to feel more connected, more inspired, just a bit more energized starts here. Take a moment now with me to reset. As you may know, purpose is one of the most important Let's Reset 7 Needs of Wellbeing and Performance. So today I was particularly excited to chat to Phil Wild, the purpose-driven CEO of James Cropper PLC. I say purpose-driven not because that's how he describes himself, but because we spend lots of time chatting about the many things he's doing in his organization to embed vision, purpose and values. He's an engineer by trade, and Phil talks about why having a technical background has really helped him become a better CEO, and how that in turn helps him relate to the people in the factories that he runs. Perhaps most interestingly, our conversation also turns to some of the darker moments in his career, when he felt like a hamster on a hamster wheel, working more than 14 hours a day. And we discuss what that taught him. Well, it shows that pleasure from being successful at work is a very, very long way away from being truly happy. I think you'll really enjoy listening to the thoughts of an authentic leader who's doing so much more now to get his own life and work in perfect harmony. Lovely to see you today. How are you?
Very well. And thank you for inviting me to join you.
Well, I'm very excited. And actually, one of the things for me is the podcast is enabling me to speak to people that I either haven't met for a long time or I've worked with in the past, or to get to meet new people. And you, Phil, are one of those people that a number of my colleagues and friends have said you've got some fantastic work that you're doing at James Cropper, but also you as a leader. And so I'm really excited to be talking to you today.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Great. Well, look, let's start with a little bit about you, Phil. Tell us a bit about you. Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Scarborough, by the seaside.
Lovely.
Dad worked in a rubber factory in Whitby, and Mum was a district nurse. So I went to school and college there. I was a keen rugby player, and loved my athletics and running and cycling. So keen on my sports, not just academic.
Oh, do you know what? So I grew up in Cornwall. And my first job when I went to university at the end of my first year, my first degree was a drama degree, actually. I went to Leeds University and I went to work in a theatre in Scarborough. Yeah. So I merrily went from Leeds to Scarborough. Now, you know, if you see where I live in Cornwall, which is on the beach in Perranporth, I assumed all beaches were like that. So I tip up to the Scarborough, and obviously I actually haven't been back there since, but there were, you know, amusement arcades along the beach. There was a whole load of stuff happening. It was actually an amazing summer for me, but it was such a shock. I just couldn't believe it.
Well, as a teenager, the arcades is where you wanted to be. If you were in the in crowd, you were in the arcades.
Right. Well, I was clearly in the in crowd without even knowing it.
On 2p machines in the arcade.
That was my memory of that summer. And also, I worked with the Beverly Sisters for the whole summer as well. So we used to go around Scarborough on a bus promoting the theatre show with me and the Beverly Sisters. So, it's good fond memories for me. So what a lovely sporty childhood. Then when you went into business, how did that happen? Where were you to begin with?
Well, once I left Scarborough, I joined a company called Lucas, and I joined as an apprentice engineer. So that was in Rochester, in Kent. And I joined on an apprenticeship scheme where it was all very hands-on. I went to college in Kent and learned all the engineering tools like welding and casting and so on. In fact, one of the things you do as an apprentice engineer, one of the first jobs you have is to make your own toolkit. So you make the hammer.
Wow.
Make all the different tools and make the box that it goes in and so on. I've still, to this day, I have still got that toolkit. And they are in pristine condition, although they do get used as well. So yeah, so I was in, I joined Lucas, and then I went to university. And I went to university whilst I was working for Lucas. So I did a manufacturing and management degree in Loughborough. And Loughborough was a choice because it was a sporting university.
Sporty, yeah.
And this, Suki, is probably a bit of an awakening for me, because I always saw myself as quite good at sport. I used to run 100 metres and deem... In Scarborough, I was the top dog of 100 metres in my age. And I went to Loughborough University and I went to trial out for the athletics at university. And I did dismally compared to everybody else. So it was a bit of an awakening for me. Needless to say, I found myself doing sports for the hall, but I found that the social side was probably a better opening for me than it was for the athletic side. So a bit of all sorts as we went through that.
But that's really interesting, isn't it? Because I grew up in Cornwall. I was really good at drama and theatre, and I was kind of did all sorts of stuff. Okay at sport, I suppose. And then went to Leeds and realised, I did a degree. I didn't even go to drama school. I wasn't very good. And actually, I think that had a massive impact on me and how I then went into business and the way that I behaved probably at the beginning of my working career. Did it positively impact you, or was it just one of those things you went, oh, it doesn't matter, I'm going to do sport in a different way, I'm going to concentrate on my career?
No, I think all of this is about learning. I enjoy sports. I'm naturally quite a competitive person, but I enjoy sports. And today it's lasted with me as well. And even talking to my children, I think sport is good for both your physical health, but also your mental health as well. And it's something that I really help to promote. So. Whether you're top of the game or not, and I kind of said that as humorously as old town like Scarborough, you were pretty good, and then you go to one of the top sporting universities in the whole of the UK and you find you're not, it's like welcome to reality. So that in itself is it's a good learning process. But I think also just keeping things going and keeping things in moderation is also important as well. And today I don't run the 100 meters anymore. I'm way too slow. I'm in the wrong shape now. I still keep up the running. I still keep up cycling. I don't do rugby anymore because that hurts. But keeping that sort of sporting mentality going, I think it's really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll come on and talk a little bit about your own well-being and what you do for that in a little bit later. So you've got that kind of background of learning about manufacturing, about, a dad who'd worked in a kind of factory environment. So then how did you get to where you are now, James Cropper?
So I graduated from university in 92. And I then joined a company called 3M, an American organization, and I joined as an engineer. So literally just straight out of university. I didn't take any time out. And I moved into an engineering, a manufacturing and a production role. And I did that for probably about the 3 to 4 years of my career. And as I went through that, there was a learning point for me that I actually wasn't I wasn't really a very good engineer. And I was working across, you know, with other colleagues, and we were working on particular projects, whether it was a product development or improving a process. And some of the work that they were doing was outstanding. And I found myself in a position where I wasn't really enjoying the sort of content that I had as, you know, as an engineer, and actually found that the quality of other people's work was actually substantially better than my own. What I did find very enjoyable was working alongside others. And I found myself very quickly moving into supervisory type roles. So I worked on a three-shift system as a team leader and a production supervisor, and learned a heck of a lot, way more than I would have learned, continuing the role of an engineer. And I found myself moving more and more into the area of, you know, people management, people development, you know, organizational change, organizational development. And I spent, I should add, by the way, I only planned to stay with 3M for about 2 or 3 years as a wide-eyed young student moving into to industry, thinking I was going to sort of bounce around a number of different companies. Yeah, I ended up being there for over 20 years.
Wow.
And I spent the first 10 years in manufacturing, in a pure manufacturing role with, you know, manufacturing, managing different manufacturing sites in Northern Ireland and around the UK, and then at some point multi sites around Europe. And then about halfway through my career, I made the leap of moving into business and business management. And I found that quite tough, because typically others, my counterparts who were running sort of similar roles, managing director type roles, had come through typically a sales and marketing background and not a manufacturing background. And so I found myself on quite a learning curve to really educate myself on the commercial skills to do with the role. Mm. And so I engaged in a number of support courses, through sort of Henley and others amongst those two, but also the company were pretty good at developing people as well.
Yeah, I mean, you were there at, I know a number of people who were at 3M probably at similar sorts of times. Actually, it was a very innovative, forward-thinking company, both from a manufacturing point of view, but certainly from a leadership point of view, from a marketing point of view. Were there, as well as doing those courses, were there any individuals that really helped you make that kind of shift as well?
Well, I took on board a number of individuals, not all at the same time, to help me to act as coaches. Mm. Now, interestingly, a lot of them were retirees. So people who had been in quite senior roles were coming into it with no agenda. And, and I actually reached out because I felt I could learn a lot. And I think one of my main learnings was I did not have to be the subject matter expert. And as long as I had the right team around me who I trusted and understood, then actually I could be a pretty effective MD. Now, there was an element of credibility. I needed to understand the subjects and I needed to understand the right questions to ask, obviously. But I didn't need to know the minutiae of detail and the background to it. I built my team around me. And that was one of the biggest things that working with some coaches at the time really helped me deliver. And from that, I was MD for a number of different businesses. I actually left 3M in 2012 and I was managing director for EMEA, for one of their divisions, so looking after Europe, Middle East and Africa. There I had a number of different manufacturing sites, and a business that was, you know, you could measure in its billions. But that's because of the size of the company. And then I moved to James Cropper in 2012. And despite that the numbers are of a different, the decimal point is in a different place, because, you know, James Cropper is a 100 million turnover business. It's 600 employees. But actually, the business issues are exactly the same. The numbers are just in a different place.
Yeah. And that's fascinating, isn't it? Particularly when you've gone from a very big company to a smaller company. It's true that the challenges are so often the same. And once you get to a critical size in terms of people, in many ways, the people challenges are the same as well. Do people that you work with like the fact that you've come from that sort of engineering background? Do they feel like you're kind of one of them, that you intrinsically understand the product, perhaps in a way that some other managing directors, chief execs might not have understood it?
I think that it's important to relate to the people that you're working alongside. And I deliberately chose to come and work for James Cropper because it was a manufacturing company. I couldn't see myself going into working in the service sector, in the financial sector, or you know, other areas that were outside manufacturing. And I think that, you know, I kind of to some degree stuck to my knitting. You know, I understand manufacturing extremely well, in many different guises. You know, my background has been in pharmaceutical, in aerospace, and industrial. So it's quite a wide ranging background. So applying it to in James Cropper's business, which is a materials business, founded on paper, was actually quite an easy transition for me to make. So what I was learning about is, well, therefore, what makes James Cropper unique, and what makes, you know, what's our direction, and it allowed me to focus. But I think engaging and really understanding and working alongside the employees at James Cropper, having a manufacturing background, you know, certainly helped. But that was a deliberate intent as opposed to by accident.
Yeah. No, I can absolutely see that. So, and James Cropper's is a family business, now listed on AIM and actually grown quite dramatically since you've been there. What was it? And I come from a long line of family businesses, and I've worked a lot with family businesses because I think they have a very particular kind of culture and way of rhythm and functioning. What was it that you found maybe attractive about that beyond it being manufacturing?
Well, let me tell you a bit about James Cropper as a company, and then I can help to sort of answer that question, because it's a fascinating organization and fascinating for a number of reasons. So HQ, which is based in Kendal, in the Lake District, has been here since 1845, so over 175 years.
Yeah.
And the majority of the business in HQ is a paper business. But, you know, it spans back further than that. You know, in the 1600s and 1700s, it was a sickle mill, you know, tools to, reap crops. And it was a fulling mill after that in the 1700s. So, used to manufacture fabrics, and you'd run by water wheel and so on. So there's an absolute history of the company that goes back many, 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 many centuries. And 1845 was when the Cropper family then purchased the company, and they came from a shipping background. In fact, he fell in love with the daughter of the mill, the daughter of the owner. No, so it's a really nice, interesting background, you know, and the company, you know, it's experienced. If you think about the timeline, they experienced world wars, it's had major fires, major floods, but it's still in existence today. And one of the things that attracted me, other than the history is absolutely fascinating, the thing that attracted me was about the opportunity for the future. Any company that has lasted over 100 years clearly has something special about it, because you just don't last for that period of time unless you're doing something that is, you know, different, differentiating and unique. And despite, you know, through previous companies I've worked with, you know, it's an SME, it's a medium-sized business. It sits on the FTSE, so it's listed on AIM. There's about 600 employees. You know, today there are 4 manufacturing sites around the world, and exports is actually now well over 50%. Coming back to your question, Suki, the thing that really attracted me was there were some uniquenesses, but also things that I saw as great, great opportunities building on the past. And the uniqueness I saw is it was a family business and still is a family business. The chair of our business is 6th generation Cropper. And I engaged with the family before joining and really warmed to them. They were very passionate, really wanting the best for the people, best for the community, and clearly the best for the company as well. It's a rural location and based in the Lake District, which also brings some uniqueness and responsibility with that as well. Fantastic history, manufacturing, of course, where you know I wouldn't have gone anywhere else. But I think the thing that sort of sets it apart for me is, through the years, the pieces that have really made the company survive and will continue to in the future are, you know, its focus on innovation. And I'll share a couple of examples with you on that. Mm-hmm. In fact, let me do that now. So James Cropper is traditionally a paper business. Interestingly, the first business had introduced things like airmail. And in the Second World War, when there was a shortage of paper, you know, fabrics and sacks were then recycled in order to make paper and looking for an alternative use and so on. And also when carbon fiber had just been invented, and you know, one of the areas that they looked at was, well, can we make paper out of different materials? And so they tried carbon fiber out, realized it didn't quite stick together. So I did some bonding materials to that as well. And made paper out of carbon fiber, and then found out that it had some really unique properties. And today, our most profitable part of the company comes from one of our divisions, which is technical fiber products, which started off as experimenting with carbon fiber. Yeah, another example is the company was looking to how to really extend its sustainability credentials and where it can get different sources of raw material from. And one of the areas was looking at used coffee cups. And today we've got the world's only used coffee cup recycling operation that goes back up the supply chain into very high value products. So there's example after example after example of really doing things differently, taking a risk, taking a calculated risk, and really developing the business. But the other areas that really made me think about how attractive the company was about the attitude to change and where that thing. And I would say, without doubt, the medium to long-term thinking takes precedent over short-term thinking.
Yeah.
That was one of the biggest changes that I saw. I'm not proud to admit this, but in the past, in previous employment, I have made some short-term decisions that weren't the right thing to do for the long-term future of the business.
It's really interesting you say that, Phil. And I was wondering, I come from a family of gin makers. So my great-great-great-grandfather founded Beefeater Gin. And actually, Beefeater was founded in 1862. So, you know, not a dissimilar timeline in some ways. And when Beefeater was sold to Whitbread, it's now part of, it was part of Diageo then. The fine alcohols division was sold to my uncle, and my family still have Heyman Distillers. And my observation about their business, as in the same, Let's Reset's my fourth company, there is something when you have a family involved that makes people think longer term, because they don't just think about themselves now, they think about the generations in the future. And I was going to ask you that. So it's really interesting that that's an observation that you've got. Yeah. And it's something that changes a lot.
Stewardship, I think, is a key part of the thinking. Yes. And for me, it was incredibly refreshing to be able to make decisions that you knew potentially actually had some detrimental impacts short term, but were absolutely the right thing to do for the long-term business. And that, you know, a combination of, you know, the innovation thinking, the medium to long-term thinking, you know, the other areas I'd probably add is focused on niche markets rather than commodity, and a commitment to employees and also a commitment to the community as well. So it made it, that whole combination made it a really special proposition. And for me, it was a very easy decision to come and join the company. And at the same time, I saw massive opportunity as well.
Yeah. Well, I can see, and we'll touch on some of those. But that word stewardship is a really fantastic one, isn't it? And, you know, if we link into the seven needs of well-being and performance, the whole piece around purpose is so important to our kind of well-being and performance. How does that fit into the kind of whole purpose that the business has, but also you as an individual? How does that come together?
Well, if I can share with you here a story of not just purpose but values.
Yeah.
Some years ago, in fact, when I joined, we went through an exercise as a board, and we talked about, at that stage, we didn't talk about purpose. I think we talked about vision and mission.
Yeah, fine.
And honestly, for me, it doesn't matter. It's about
the same difference. Yeah.
The journey you go on to get there. And we sat together as a board, and we created, you know, the world's best mission and best values. And, and we typed it up, and we put it on the in a frame in the boardroom. You know where I'm going with this. Not a surprise, the engagement was not where we needed to be. So look, so more recently, and actually through COVID, we took the opportunity to really refresh our purpose and the values of the organization. And we went about it what I thought was in quite a unique way. That we took a cross section of our employees, and when I say cross section, I mean gender, age, geography, business, function. Yeah, very, very deliberately. So we ended up with about 10% of our employees as part of a working group. So 10% of our employees is around, you know, 50 to 60 employees from, you know, all different parts of the organization. And we started this off with an interview with both the chairman and myself. And the interview was us downloading about the history of the company and our passions and our thoughts about how we were going to move forward. Deliberately, we didn't talk about our purpose and we didn't talk about our values. And then through quite a number of facilitated sessions with that working group, we developed a purpose. Now, a couple of and values and a couple of really important aspects of that. We engaged, all the leadership team were engaged, so all the directors, board were engaged, and we all played a role in contributing. But I would say that the majority of time, as a leadership team, we listened and didn't talk, and let the working group really develop some of the thinking offline. And they developed a purpose statement, which is absolutely not what we would have developed in the boardroom, but makes entire sense, and I'll explain that. And also delivered what they felt was the values of the company as well, which I, you know, we totally endorsed. And just to share with you, I'll reflect back on the purpose as well in a moment, but just reflecting back on the values, one of the biggest learnings I had when we went through the values development was a mistake that I've seen being made in the past, and I think a mistake that we very nearly made, is we were about to aspire to values where we wanted to be. And where we were reminded is the company has been in its existence for over 175 years and therefore must have a strong set of values today that have lasted that period of time. And therefore, really, we should be understanding what our values are, not what they should be. And we ended up with three values that really have taken the company over the past nearly two centuries, that certainly have the capability to take the company over another two centuries as well. So anyway, so our purpose statement is pioneering materials to safeguard our future. And you know, the background to that is we're a manufacturing company. We're a materials company. And whereas we may have started off with paper, that we were the first to introduce color into paper. So we've, you know, dye technology, we're introducing new materials in there. And now, you know, we're making materials out of carbon fiber, out of polymers, out of glass, out of ceramics. We've now got a hydrogen business as well. So really materials focus. And you know, one of the core competencies of our R&D, which is, by the way, it's about 15% of our employees are engaged in R&D, so very heavily invested, yeah, are focused on the materials side. So we're, but also to some degree stick to our knitting. It's materials we understand and markets that we understand. And safeguarding our future is about us looking forward, but it's looking forward in a very responsible way of thinking about what are the right things that we should be doing. Yeah, you know, whether it's about environmental, you know, ESG credentials, and making sure that we are, it comes back to stewardship, you know, doing what is right for the future. But you know, no mistake, we want to be a profitable company and continue to improve our bottom line and our top line, but it's about doing it in the right way. So it's easy to sort of talk about the statement, but it's the meaning behind the statement.
Yeah.
Going through the process that we went through, got that deep understanding of the meaning behind the words.
Mm. And I love the fact that you've taken that sort of 10% of people to be involved in it across a really kind of diverse and inclusive part of the business. If I was to speak to one of the people involved in the program, what would they say? How has it benefited them?
I think it's provided a lot of clarity, and I think particularly around our values. And Suki, I'll share with you that previously we had 12 values. You could have put me on the spot.
At the time,
I'm sure I could have repeated all 12.
Yeah.
Today we have three.
Three is so much better. Exactly. We spent all our time telling people.
It's provided clarity of who we are and what we're about. And I think being engaged in that process, like I say, there was a lot of listening involved, pride involved in it. But what I would say is we're also on a journey. And whereas, you know, 10% of our employees were engaged, that also means that 90% weren't. So we're now going through a process of engagement through the entire organization of really sharing what this is about. But probably more importantly is, and therefore, what are the decisions that we're making based on, you know, our purpose and our values? And just to give you an example, we're in the process at the moment of looking at any unethical businesses that we've been associated with, and interestingly, we're about to exit one of the businesses. It happens to be a very small piece of business, but that it wouldn't make any difference. And it's about putting our money where our mouth is in terms of, you know, how we make business decisions based on our purpose and also based on our values as well. And you know,
I was going to say that's a really good real thing that people can see. Is there other some behaviors, perhaps particularly around the leadership team? You said that one, listening is very good, that maybe the staff might see in the leadership team now that you've got this very clear focus on your values and where you're going, that they might see different behaviours?
I think, both attitude and behaviours, all sort of formulating a culture. And I think that was one of the most important learnings of when we defined our values. Because had we set values that actually we don't have but we aspire to, then it would have been completely out of kilter with our culture. And because we've set the values of actually this is who we are, this is what we're about, it's really aligned to who we are and what we do and so on. And what we're trying to do now is just elevate those and make more of them than we do. So an example would be recruitment.
Yeah.
And when we might find on paper the world's best person, but ultimately, if they're not aligned to our values, it's not going to work. And what we've recognized is that the alignment to our values and as you point out, behaviors is so important to be supportive of the company, supportive of your colleagues, and to create the right culture. And as we're starting to storytell about our values and why they're there, as we're starting to make actions around business decisions, recruitment, development, it's really starting to embed it. And I think we're right at the start of that journey. I think we're seeing that in the leadership, but I think it's got a lot further to go as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually really excited about what this looks like, because the biggest learning is we've just realized who we are and what we're about. Now let's make hay out of that and really maximize what we can do as an organization by taking that to the next level.
And if we're here again in a year's time, and I say, like, how's it going? How are these values? Is it making a difference? How will you measure that? And maybe a year obviously isn't going to be enough time, but what sort of things are you looking at to measure, or is it a feel?
So we have made a couple of changes on the back of this recently. And despite being an SME, we're a matrixed organization. We have three different businesses, one focused on paper, very much bespoke, looking after some of the world's biggest brands. We have a Colourform business, which is a plastic-free packaging business. Looking after premium and luxury brands. We have a technical fibre business, which typically works in the composite area for aerospace, but also hydrogen and wind and so on. And one of the changes that we've made is, whereas the businesses were typically focused on the front end, what I would describe as sales and marketing, whereas all the sort of engineering and the operations was run as a group,
yep.
We've now split the three businesses out. So a business now, so we have three very different divisions who are now totally responsible and accountable throughout the whole supply chain, through customers right down to operations, down to suppliers and so on. And what that's allowed us to do is to say to each of the businesses, you are responsible for your own destiny. You're not reliant on the group. You can develop your own policies and principles, and to some degree, subculture, in order to help to support your business grow, which is actually entirely different from how we had it before. However, you must adhere to the group purpose and the group values, in order to grow your business. If not, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But to help to answer the question, Suki, is the reason for doing this is about growing our business. But it's about growing the business in the right way. So I would measure it. I could easily measure it financially in 12 months time, top and bottom line for each three of the business. I could measure it through employee engagement. As for each one of the divisions that are starting to see a much closer alignment to what they're doing today of the contribution to the business. But then there's a whole series of soft measures as well. You know, how you feel about, morale and pride. What does the community think about the company? How is that? What contribution have we made to the environment? Obviously some of which can be measured and some of which is also a bit of a feel as well.
Yeah, I can see that. The other thing I'm interested in what you're doing, and we work with manufacturing companies like Ardagh, the glass and metals products company, Keepak, the meat manufacturing company. And when we've put programs in with them, one of the challenges that we've grappled with in the last 18 months is the difference between people working in the factory and people working in the head office. And you talked a little bit about, you've got a restructure, so you've got a kind of single supply chain. When you're now doing what you're trying to do, which is to elevate this sense of values and culture, I guess, is that a challenge for you, or are you looking at it differently? What are you doing to try and understand the different kind of needs, but also the way that that different parts of the company respond to change or embrace an initiative like this?
Yeah, to some degree, we're quite fortunate that the different roles are all based in the same location. So we're able to do a lot more cross-fertilization with a wide-ranging teams in order to sort of have that sort of true representation of what we're doing. Visibility and communication is so important. In fact, one of the things that I learned many years ago of going through change, there are three things that are really important: communication. And that obviously can be done in a whole wide range. And one of the best ways, clearly is in person. So to have, to have your teams working together, particularly now, we're working in three separate divisions. So, within one division, you've got representatives of, the shop floor, you've got representatives of marketing and finance and so on. And to have all that team physically together, face to face, working through some of the challenges you've got, it really helps to enrich some of the solutions that you come through. And so, and again, we're still in it's not a new concept to us by any means, but we're still in early days as we've separated out the three divisions. But it's really clear that in the past there have been some frustrations of three businesses which are actually quite different to each other, of having some discussions about us as a group versus us as separate businesses. And I can see that the frustrations will ease as we're talking specifically, what can you do to help this business move forward, and what can we do to help to make our jobs easier?
Yeah, I can see that. And as the chief exec and very senior and the person leading this in many ways, what have you looked at yourself? What have you learned about yourself during this process, but also the kind of leadership style you might have now and in the future that you might, along the reset of the business, you might want to reset in yourself?
I've gone through a journey of joining the company. I would say I've moved from quite hands-on to quite hands-off. One of the roles for a chief exec is when there's a gap at a senior leadership, you fill it. Clearly you can't be doing that all the time, but you can't leave something as a complete void. So I've actually been MD for at least two of our three businesses whilst being CEO as well, as we've recruited people into the right roles and had the right succession planning coming in. So, I've spent a long time being quite hands-on and really helping to get involved in the minutiae and building the business up. And I'll say probably in the last sort of 3 to 4 years, I've managed to sort of step back a lot from that and think a lot more strategically and long-term about the business in terms of where we're heading. And I've now, in the last 2 years, managed to take some time out. So I'm now developing, so I'm working with things like Wharton University, with alongside other global CEOs to think about, what's happening in the world, what's some of the best practices, getting input in from things like Harvard and so on. I'm really helping to sort of sharpen my saw of the way forward. So looking differently. So my role has changed. I would say also that I see, going back to sort of stewardship, I see stewardship now differently than when I did when I joined. And I would say when I joined, I was looking, very short to medium term to get the right team in place, get the right footings, make sure we were going in the right direction. And certainly my time horizons have changed quite substantially. Of course, there are some short-term challenges, as there always are, but my time has moved quite substantially to looking not just medium-term, but long-term at the business of where we're heading, strategically, what's the business about, and where could we be, not just in 2 or 3 years' time, but actually what does a 10-year horizon look like for the company, and how we can really achieve our objectives. And, clearly some of those are financial, but by all means, they're not all financial objectives that we're trying to achieve.
Yeah. I can see that. That's brilliant that you've now been able to make that kind of step back and think about it from that point of view. We've talked quite a lot now about the values you've got. Let's Reset, we focus particularly on creating diverse and inclusive workplaces and the well-being and energy of people. It's been a very challenging time, particularly in the last 18 months, and those kind of programs alongside the focus on ESG for a lot of businesses become increasingly important. You said at the beginning, sport is important to yourself. What have you done, firstly, within the business to help people alongside this, perhaps think about their own well-being, their own energy during this last pandemic time?
Almost counter to some of the things that we've talked about engagement, thinking medium to long term. When the pandemic hit, we acted very, very quickly to respond to it. and there wasn't an enormous amount of engagement. So we really led from the front as a leadership team. And clearly we had our ear to the ground, but we did not have the time to consult, to have working groups of how we were going to do things and so on. And so we acted very quickly. But one of the very first things that we did, we put some priorities in place of all the decision making that we're doing. How are we going to prioritize that? And the first priority was the health and well-being of our employees. And that followed on with cash from the company. And it also followed on with looking after our customers. That was it. Those were our three priorities. And in that order, we wanted to make sure our employees were looked after properly in the right way. And I'll explain that in a little bit more detail. The company had to survive. We had to be here after the pandemic. So we needed to manage cash. And we needed to manage it with the same customer base as we had before. And I'm actually very pleased to say that we've ridden that storm very well. We've come out to the other side of it. But an example would, we moved, like many companies, super quickly to exit staff and work from home. Yeah. Easy to say. IT infrastructure is less easy to do that. But we're a manufacturing site, so we had to continue to operate. So all the sort of health and safety measures that we had on board. But the other area would be not just the physical side of wearing masks and sanitization and so on and screens and so on and so forth, but was there the mental side as well? And we were supporting companies with going through mental health issues at the time. That might be from the anxiety of the situation, but also actually working from home for some individuals was a very lonely circumstance. Through lockdown, and through supervisors, through the teams, we set up a number of mental health support for our group as well. And as momentum moved forward, social groups started to establish, Zoom social groups, Friday night pizza and wine via Zoom and so on. So You know, so but I think that kind of lends itself a lot more to the culture of the organisation, of looking after each other and being quite a close community that, you know, people have worked together for many, many years and they're looking out for each other.
Yeah, well, that's good. And I think you're right. So many companies have seen that you just needed to make that decision very quickly and look after both the physical and the mental well-being. We're nearly out of time now, but you know, you talked about exercise, so physical well-being. We also know that one of the other seven needs of well-being and performance is having a creative outlet. You have an interesting hobby that when I go into your LinkedIn, in the back of your LinkedIn, you have a video cam of you doing something. What is it that you're doing, Phil?
Well, you're well done for seeing that. It's I thought I hit that quite well, actually. But it's one of those you have to look for. So that's me racing through a forest with a camera on my helmet on one of my bikes. So whereas I used to love running, and I still do to some extent, but I'm certainly not as fast as I used to be by any means. I do a lot of cycling and a lot of off-road cycling, so mountain biking, gravel biking, and being blessed with the Lake District. Yeah, there's some fantastic roads there. It's a good team event. It's good to do with colleagues. It's good to do on your own. It's something you can't be shy about with the weather.
Yes,
there are lakes in the Lake District for a reason, and so very, very passionate. It's a great way to relax, take your mind off things, and go and do something. Because when you're going through a forest downhill at 30 miles an hour, you have nothing else to focus on other than where the roots are, so you don't fall off the bike.
No, I know. Do you know, I do a little bit, and I always fall off my bike. It's so annoying. But yeah, it's just fabulous, isn't it? It's really good. So physical exercise is great. What do you do for your mental well-being, Phil?
That's a great point. So I do quite a bit of relaxing as well. And Suki, I actually think this is one of my personal challenges for the next 12 months, is to up my game. I like to be busy. I love my job. I enjoy working. I enjoy doing things. If I was to score myself out of 10 of doing things, I'd say I'm probably 9.5 out of 10. If I was to score myself on relaxing, I'm probably about 1 or 2 out of 10. And for me, that is a personal goal of something that I want to improve myself on a little more. I certainly think of times in my life I actually needed a technique of how to relax better than I could have done, and it was also part of my learning at the time, and probably quite tough learning of not able to switch off and not able to relax really didn't help the situation that you're in. In fact, made it worse. I've learned more about that. I do a little bit of meditation now. I do a lot more relaxing. I listen to podcasts, obviously. But it's something I want to move. I want to be over this time next year. I want to be over 5 out of 10 on that.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a great thing to try and do, because it's so interesting. And I was very similar to you for a long time. Being busy, particularly if you enjoy something, and you know, we work a lot with very high performance leaders, very high performance cultures, and there's a definite feeling of being superhuman, isn't there? And superhuman kind of means always on, doing stuff. Superhuman doesn't mean taking time to do exactly that, to calm your brain down, to take those moments of pausing, to teach yourself to meditate, to focus in a different way. And I think that we're learning more and more about the benefits of doing that. And you as a leader, you know, you're doing some amazing resets. But I think getting that as a skill will help you even more over the next 12 months. So good.
That's one of my key focus. I mean, maybe close to time here, but just as a soundbite, in a previous role, I was looking after the Middle East and Africa, working for an American company. And by the time I woke up in the morning, Middle East and Africa had been awake for several hours. So I was catching up, working for an American company. By the time it was my bedtime, you know, the Americans were still up and going. So I was working 12 to 14 hour days every day. And I spent nearly 3 years without a proper holiday. I would be on holiday, but I wouldn't be on holiday, if you know what I mean. And, you know, and we had big highs and big lows. I felt like a hamster on a hamster wheel. You know, you just keep going. And I think one of my biggest learnings from that was, yeah, I received pleasure when, you know, we managed to sort of get over a big challenge that we were trying to do. I had pretty much no happiness in the role. And, you know, really trying to differentiate the difference between being truly happy with the role and what you're doing rather than just pleasure seeking. And you know, and actually the result of that, I actually left the company because of that. And one of the things I was looking for was that far more balanced view of, you know, what I was trying to personally get out of my, you know, my life and my career.
Janelle, thank you for sharing that. I love that focus on the difference between pleasure and happiness. And you're absolutely right. And I can see just from your story, from your passion today, you've really, you know, focused on so many of the right things now. You're making some fantastic inroads. Thank you for sharing some of the story and the tips that you've got, because I think that's a brilliant journey to go on. But I think also from a personal point of view, you know, that obviously that pursuit of a balance that enables you to be happy as well as effective at work is making a big difference for you and for James Cropper. So, Phil, an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you very much. And I look forward to maybe in a year's time, we'll come back again and see how you've got on with your mental well-being, but also the journey at James Cropper. So thanks very much.
Absolute pleasure, Sue. When my daughter was 13, she had lumps on her neck, and she went to see the doctor. In fact, she went to see a number of doctors, and they diagnosed her with glandular fever. So she went for the glandular fever. Anyway, it turns out it was negative, and eventually they took a biopsy, and we found out that she was stage 3 Hodgkin's lymphoma, and that was one of the times in your life when a doctor says to you in front of your daughter that, you know, she has stage 3 cancer, and your daughter looks at you and says, am I going to be okay? And of course your answer is yes, you are going to be okay. And by the way, it was a dreadful time. Went through chemo. I would hasten to add before I go too further, she's fit and well today. But she went through months and months of chemotherapy and radiotherapy, spent months permanently in hospital, you know, taking a treatment, and was very, very ill with her treatment. She missed out on many years of school because of that. So a very, very, very difficult journey that she went on. And I think for me, there are two positives I've taken out from that. One is you have to think positively, even in your darkest hour, because other people are relying on you, which is sometimes quite a hard burden to have, but you have a responsibility, particularly as a parent, a responsibility. Personally, I find myself sometimes in situations where business can be really, really tough.
Yeah.
And I remind myself of that time and I say, that's not tough. That's not tough. And I sometimes ask myself, you know, in a business environment, a work environment, what's the worst thing that could happen? Well, okay, maybe I lose my job. That's okay. That's okay. I could live with that. You know, so it helps for me. It really reset, and it helped put the world into context of actually what's important in life. So that for me, and I still hold that true to this day.
Yeah, gosh, that's so hard. And thank you for sharing that. So I don't know if you know, but I've had cancer five times, actually. So it's a journey that I've been on for the last 13 years. And I completely understand your point about of course, business during that time has been tough. COVID has been tough. But actually, for me, I'm like, do you know what? I've never had that moment again of going, well, I think I might die. So for me, it has never been. No business situation has been that tough. The other thing that I found, particularly at the beginning of the journey, was they have something that psychologically is called post-traumatic growth. And I wonder whether you or your daughter or your family experienced this as well, which was, of course, that's a very dark time. It's really, really hard. But actually, what can happen afterwards is you can, in some ways, leap forward more than you would have done if that big moment in time hadn't happened. And I wonder whether that's happened for you or your family at all.
I think so. Yeah, I think also it takes time to get there. You know, you go through an acceptance and putting things, understanding the reality of a situation. And I actually would say, in certainly my daughter's circumstance, she dipped before she grew. Even when she'd finished her course of chemotherapy, and they never actually say you're fine, unfortunately, but they do say is we see no evidence, which is we'll take that, take every bit. She actually dipped after that.
And was that right at the end afterwards? Because I remember at the end of my first sort of treatment, everyone was jumping up and down going, you must be so pleased. I'm like, I am, but why do I not feel pleased? Why do I just feel exhausted and emotionally battered and just I'm not great?
Well, she spent probably the next 24 months on antidepressants after that.
Did she? Gosh, that's hard.
And now, you know, I mean, look, life ain't perfect, but now she's, she's 21, beautiful girl, having fun, challenging a 21-year-old, but she's there.
Wow. What's her name?
Lauren.
Lauren, gosh, she sounds like an amazing, amazing girl. You must be
just graduated
super proud.
With a 2-1 as well, so that's even better. Oh,
she's a very special, very, very special girl. And is that why you're on the Teenage Cancer Trust?
It is, yes. Yeah.
Has that helped?
Yes. Well, two part. Does the Teenage Cancer Trust help teenagers? Yes, they do.
Yeah.
And also, it's easy to say there's a bit of payback there. But I gain my own satisfaction about helping, because I understand how important it is for others.
So. Yeah. I went onto the board of Macmillan Cancer Support for 9 years nearly, and I found it was my best way of positively every month thinking about a positive outcome to the cancer journey I'd been on and doing something rather than either ignoring it and forgetting it or worrying about it. It actually just meant I could do something. Phil, thank you for sharing that, gosh. And good luck to Lauren, and good luck to you and your family. And thank you again. What an amazing conversation.
Thanks, Suki.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed Reset the podcast, I'd love it if you would forward it to your work colleagues, friends, and family. Reset the Podcast is a Let's Reset and Advertising Week global production. Executive producer is Richard Larson, with me, Suki Thompson. Thanks to our sponsor, Liars Non-Alcoholic Spirits, and voiceover artist, Talitha Penny. Music provided by Audio Network.